Hey, what's good, everyone? This is Rich.
I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to the Paychecks and Balances podcast, where we talk all things work and money with the hope we don't leave you saying, man, come on.
And if you've been enjoying the podcast, tell a friend about the show. You can easily share it on Twitter by going to paychecksandbalances.com/tweet.
And if you just discovered the show on iTunes, subscribe and hit us with the 5 stars. You know, helps us stay visible without having to resort to gimmicks like wearing meat suits or other shenanigans that a lot of people would find inappropriate.
If I may jump in, I've heard this meat suits reference a few times. Where is it from?
Lady Gaga, a few years ago at like one of the music award shows, she came out like wearing steaks.
I thought so, but I just wanted to make sure. And you can tweet along to today's episode using hashtag or pound PayBal. And you can add us directly at PayBalances or email us aggressively at info@paychecksandbalances.com.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. And today we're joined by Katisha, an all around dope individual who happens to be a Paychecks and Balances listener. She emailed us in response to PB18, the cash only episode. Turns out she has a pretty robust bank account system, way more robust than mine or probably yours, I imagine, Marcus.
Definitely mine as well.
And upon further research, it turns out she's a woman in engineering that survived the gauntlet that is a PhD program. Hashtag she did that. Thanks for joining us, Katisha.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So we're going to have a little bit of fun today. But before we got into talking about the work and money stuff, I saw on your LinkedIn profile that you were a military kid. So if you can talk a little bit about what that life was like for you growing up.
Yeah. So my dad was the military person. He was in the Marine Corps. So mostly it was moving to different places when I was younger, living on base, having a whole different experience than most people do. Most people like have a house they grew up in and they stayed there until they went to college. And I've lived in a number of houses and I really don't have a hometown. I just call wherever I'm living a hometown.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, cause I was going to say the military kid thing, it seems like more of a lifestyle or some exclusive society of people that move around a lot. And you pretty much just echoed that that's what it's like. So what were some of the biggest challenges for you as you were doing all of that moving around? Like, was it harder to make and keep friends because you always knew you were going to be going somewhere else or, you know, go bouncing from school to school and feeling like you had to consistently reset? I guess, what were some of those challenges?
Yes, definitely. It's always hard being the new kid on the block, especially when you go to a school, like for military kids, you're either living off base or on base. Mm. So when we lived off base, the school was mostly like a school where all the kids knew each other. They'd been together for years and I was the new kid on the block. So it's kind of hard to adjust. It was easier when we moved on base and like all the kids were military kids. So everyone understood that we'd be friends this year, but you might not be here next year and that's okay. And then it's also harder because back when I was a kid, there was no internet, Facebook. So it's kind of hard to keep track of people.
Ooh. So you just had to like use the phone? Like just how did that?
Yeah. You either had to use the phone or you just lost track of your friends and then you find them now on Facebook when they're grown up and they have kids too. It's kind of weird to see people you went to middle school and elementary school with grown up with kids.
Yeah, that's even weird to me. I don't know about you, Marcus. When I got people who I haven't seen or heard from since like fifth grade and somehow they find me on Facebook and I'm like, oh, you pushed me that one time. I'll never forget that.
Man, you know, I've talked about this for years. I'm not as social as all the various social media accounts that I've been on would seem to indicate. It's like, what was it, 10 years? Like, I just joined Facebook. Like, my Facebook timeline went joined in 2014, no updates, and then in 2016, updated profile picture. Like, so like, I was anti-Facebook for a very long time, and I'm still on the fence about it now. I mean, it's definitely a strange environment. What is it like? You go on Twitter to associate with people you want to associate with, and Facebook is people that you went to school with, or you know, it's like you know them, but you don't know them.
Yeah,
and yeah, it's been some, especially with all the politics and everything going on right now. Like these people I went to school with in fifth grade have views from the six.
Yeah, I try to. So I actually have two Facebook accounts and I try to stay away from one of them because it gets way too turnt in a way that I don't like it to. Basically, like half the people that I went to school with, I see them posting stuff and I'm like, all right, that's probably why we never talked. That's probably why I didn't take that ride home from you, because I knew you were going to turn into this person one day. But before we go too far down the rabbit hole, so I was wondering how many... Go ahead.
Before we move on too far, I did have a question. So I didn't have a military background or my family, but we moved around a lot within state. And I was wondering, have you had a shared experience as far as how it shaped your interactions with other individuals, either personally, professionally, or in relationships? Because for myself, because we moved all the time, moving is really not a big deal to me. Like I can, if I got the right opportunity, honestly, I'll hop up and move right now. And that's like groundbreaking to some people. Have you had that as well? Like, is moving still a big deal to you, or it's just like something that's a part of life?
No, I definitely, it's not a big deal. And I have surprised people too. I think where I live now, I've been here for 5 years and I've lived in 3 different apartments.
Wow.
So I definitely know how to pack up my apartment and move at a moment's notice. And it's also easy for me. It's like, oh, this opportunity's here. You got to move. I'm like, okay, not a big deal. I'm used to moving. Okay. Definitely down with moving if I have to.
Okay, that's good to hear, because people make me like, they treat me like I'm insane. I'm like, the opportunity's over there. Why wouldn't you go over there? They're like, but I've lived here all my life and I'm going to live here for the next lifetime. And my kids' kids are going to live here through their lifetime. I'm like, oh, man. Nah.
Nah,
the idea of that actually scares me a lot.
Yeah, see, and I'm someone who never thought I would leave the, I think it, in some ways I thought I would leave the East Coast, but even before I moved to California, I was like, man, I'm not moving to California. I don't know nobody out there. I don't got friends out there. Only way I'm gonna go out there is if I get a job with a particular company. And then that actually happened. And then I was like, okay, we actually got to make this move. But that lack of flexibility to be able to move around the country or around the world, in some ways that probably impacts the type of opportunities that people are going to have available to them and where they can even go in their career.
Definitely. I mean, the moves that I made, some of them were just impulsive. I mean, that's why I kind of asked about it. I think it's somewhat of a mental thing. It's just not that big of a deal to me to move. I've sold all my stuff twice. Like if it didn't fit in the car, I sold it. And like if it's not tied down, I'll get rid of it. I mean, I guess I have like a limited, yet I like to spend, but I don't have an attachment to material things, which is probably an interrelated relationship that we can explore in another show. But as far as like where the opportunities are, I'm just willing to go there. Like the only commitment I've given people lately, now that I'm back home in Texas, because the people are like, are you here? Are you here? Are you moving again? Because now people are used to me moving, is like, I can only tell you I'll probably stay in Texas. That, but like as far as city, like I don't know what to tell you on that front.
Yeah, that's like a really, really big state. I swear I was driving across Texas for like 6 hours or something insane like that when we were going across the country.
Man, look, I drove, and I talked about this, when I drove from Colorado back here, which is a 13-hour drive, New Mexico looked like something out of one long Chainsaw Massacre movie. Like it was terrifying. I'm like, if my car breaks down, I'm just gonna start crying. Like there was nothing to see forever, except everything you did see was terrifying looking. It looked like those shack rundown homes that like the massacre guy was just waiting behind the doors. I'm like,
those have eyes.
Yeah. Like New Mexico is terrifying. My hat's off to anybody who lives there.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. So, Katisha, how many places do you think you've lived so far?
It's been 5 states.
Mm.
And then dispersed within those states have been different cities.
Okay.
So I could say for the longest, I've lived in North Carolina the longest, but it's kind of been a back and forth because since my dad was in the Marine Corps, that's like the biggest base on the east side of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to grad school in Maryland, so I lived there a few years.
Okay, so it's been pretty domestic. You know, it's not like you were living in France, then living in Portugal, then living in some other obscure town somewhere.
No, because most of the time it was my dad that was deployed, and then we just stayed home on base while he was deployed for 6 months a year, however long it is.
And so how was it dealing with that? You know, because And this is something that I hear a lot about, where you have all of this time where you have, you know, one parent that's consistently away. So how did you kind of handle dad being away, you know, for 6 months at a time? Or was it something you just got used to and that was a part of life?
Yeah, I think it's hard to deal with initially, but after a while, you just kind of get used to it. And then it sort of feels like dad is just a visitor. It's like when your grandparents come to visit you and they're there for a week or so and then they're gone. It was more kind of like that. And so I think I'm more closer to my mom than my dad because of that. So it's like hard to get to know your dad. It's like getting to know your parent and you're both adults. It's sort of weird.
But it's like they were there. It's not like the absentee story, though, where it's like dad was just like gone doing crazy things in all sorts of cities around the U.S. Like he was gone basically for work, you know?
Right. It's like extended dad on out of town for work.
Got it. So let's talk a little bit about education. So when and what made you decide that you wanted to be an engineer?
It's sort of been there in the background for a long time. I know I did this program when I was a kid. You got to spend a summer at a university and work with engineers. And they gave us this poster that had like a bunch of engineers and scientists on it. And they were all Black, which was something I'd never seen before. And they were all doctors, which I thought was really cool. Even though I didn't know what that meant, it still looked cool. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of back there in my head. I just didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. So it kind of took me some time to figure out what exactly I want to do. Because for a little bit, I wanted to be an architect. Mm-hmm. I was obsessed with Frank Lloyd Wright. I don't know if anybody knows Frank Lloyd Wright, but he designs these amazing buildings and houses.
I had not heard that name till today, but now I got to hitch the Googles.
Yeah, he has some really cool designs. I think one Christmas, my mom even bought me this calendar planner that had like all of his designs in it. Mm. I kept it for a really long time, even after that year expired.
So I imagine at some point there was a switch where, you know, of course, you went from wanting to be an architect and then into mechanical engineering. So do you remember when you realized that and what solidified that that was the route that you wanted to go?
It was sort of my mom teaching me to be practical, because she was engineering. I mean, architecture is fun, but it's kind of hard to get a job as an architect. It's kind of a fad, not like a fad, but a hard thing to get into because it's a small niche area. And once you're in there, you're kind of in there and it's really hard to get new people in there. Mm. So mechanical engineering was sort of like a broad engineer, because mechanical engineers can basically go to whatever specialties they like. They sort of had the base, the foundation of all the engineering practices.
You know, in 30 years, I've never heard somebody said, you know, I took the easier route and I went with mechanical engineering.
Yo, that's what I was thinking. I'm sitting here and I'm like, oh, you know.
I'm like, I think I went to like social music 101, so music theory or something was my backup plan. But that's good to hear. Yeah, it's good to hear.
There was a period where I thought I wanted to be an engineer. And I think a lot of people went through that stretch where it's like, oh, what are jobs that pay a lot of money? I was like a lawyer. I was like, I'm not going to be a lawyer. Like, oh, a doctor, like too much school and too much science. And I don't like blood that much, even though I like crappy horror movies. And then I took the SAT2 math, which that's probably the only test that I've ever walked out of in my life. And let's just say that my engineering dreams quickly went by the wayside thereafter.
And I also want to say, and maybe Rich, you could talk a little bit about your experience as far as those programs. I mean, I want to plug for the show. That's good to hear. I think seeing the perspective of other, I'm going to go there, African-Americans in fields of success is, besides sports and the celebrity route, is limited to us. Because I did I did an urban youth program. They took us to New York. They took us to the Hershey factory. We met the Sprite marketing team. And essentially, they were just trying to show us that there is more than the urban experience limited to this 8-square block in which y'all live in. And it shaped my perspective of, hey, there's for like a lifetime, like there's more out there than this. And I think a lot of people either don't take advantage of that or they don't know that those programs exist. Mine, I mean, it wasn't, I think the traditional ones folks know is like the NAACP, and that's, but I feel like that's the only one people know about. And there's so many programs to choose from. There's people doing so much. So I definitely want to plug those. And I'm glad to hear that that really opened your eyes to another opportunity and kind of sounds like set the foundation for success.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, man. So, and so you mentioned seeing, you know, pictures of doctors and stuff like that and realizing that that was a possibility. But were there programs that you were a part of that you think were kind of key to the foundation of getting to where you are now?
In elementary school, not really. I think that was the only program I did, that summer program. Mm-hmm. In high school, I was a really nerdy kid, so it's going to sound really nerdy, but I went to science camp. At university.
I just want to point out, nerds are in. That's the wave. Nerds are lit this year.
Yeah, I actually thickened my glasses on purpose.
Yeah, so I did go to science camp and I spent a summer there. And it was kind of a research-oriented thing where we were learning science techniques, keeping a journal, logging your observations and results. So that was a good experience for me. And then also in undergrad, I was part of the Ronald McNair Scholars Program.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that gave me another opportunity to spend a summer doing research. I also did a summer research experience, undergrad research experience. I think they call it REUs, research experience for undergraduates, mm-hmm. where you kind of get a inkling into what grad school's like doing research, collaborating with other people. So it's kind of like every, like elementary school, high school, there's kind of one experience that sort of gave me the push to go to my next experience with the next thing I was going to do.
So let me ask, was it self-initiated? Was it a networking opportunity, a mother, father? I guess, how did those opportunities come available?
It was mostly, I think it was more self. I think I push myself more than anyone else pushes me. Most of the time I say, I want to do this, and then I figure out a way to do that.
Okay, very nice.
I was going to ask that. I'm glad we're in sync here, brother. I'm glad we're in sync, man.
trying to get some nuggets for the listeners, you know, what they should grab onto.
And so, as I mentioned up front, you made this brave decision to go after your PhD. So what sparked that for you?
Mostly, it's hard to say, but it's mostly like I wanted to do it. I don't know if anyone ever is like, I just got a PhD because I wanted to get one.
I never heard that before.
Yeah. I don't think that ever happens, but that was really the reason why. I just thought it seemed like a cool thing to do, to say that I got a PhD and you can call me doctor.
Ooh, so let me back up a bit. You know, so I realized I probably should have did that intro with Dr. Katisha, PhD. You know, let me take a step back there. And I guess in terms of going through that program, was there anything that was really surprising to you, maybe from what you thought, you know, being a PhD student was like before to actually being in the thick of it?
It's crazy when you go in undergrad, you like really care about your GPA. You're like, I gotta get an A, I gotta get an A. And in graduate school, that's not the case. Most of the time, all you need is a 3.0. And when you finish, no one's gonna ask you what your GPA is. All they care is that you finished your program because it's more about the research than the classes. Mm. So that was one thing I learned. Even though the classes are really hard, the grades are less important than you think. Although you can't get C's. That's one thing. No C's in grad school. But it's really hard to get a C. You have to like do nothing to get a bad grade. If you're putting in the work and the effort, the teacher will, professors will reward the effort.
That actually makes it sound a little bit more enticing, even though I still know that it's insane. Because it's, what is it? Is it 4 years to get a PhD?
Actually, a PhD is however long it takes for you to get it.
Oh,
I can say that it took me 5 years, but I know people where it took them 10 years.
Yeah, I think I have a colleague is the best word, that took 8 years. Yeah, so I thought that's just how long it took. So maybe he didn't share that part of the story.
Yeah, it also depends on your program because a lot of PhDs take longer because it's research based. So it's basically how long it takes you to get significant results. So a lot of times physics PhDs and biology PhDs take a really long time. And it's not necessarily because of the person. It's just how long it takes you to get significant results for your research and publish enough papers. There's a lot of times, you have to publish a certain amount of papers before they let you defend.
I think this person listens to the show is what I was going to say. So I'm not going to confirm or deny whether that was his specialty. I think he knows why it took 8 years. So yeah. As far as, all the discussions around school debt and is college worth it, I was kind of wondering if you had any thoughts on pros, cons, or what you would recommend to others, and maybe kind of broken out by undergraduate, graduate, and doctorate. Like what would you share with others would be the reason to either not or to continue pursuing those two, or I guess those three areas?
I would say, well, I had to use loans for undergraduate and graduate. So I'm like dealing with a significant loan debt. Even with, you're going to engineering, you get a pretty good paying job, but it's mm-hmm. still the, especially where I went to graduate school, it was an expensive place to live. So I kind of used loans to help me live basically because graduate pay is very, very low. It's basically like working at McDonald's.
So I've heard.
So that's one thing. And I would also say especially for engineering, like you don't necessarily need a PhD. Actually, you probably don't. It was sort of a personal thing for me. Mm-hmm. So if you feel like you have to get a PhD for engineering, you really don't. Most of the time a master's will do. And a master's is really a lot of times what companies want. And I would also say a lot of time when I was in school, they didn't have this, but I know a lot of times now you can get your bachelor's and master's together. Like if you stay an extra year, you can basically get both. So I'd really recommend if that's available at your school, then you do that. You just take a couple of extra classes and you basically graduate in 5 years with a master's and a master's and a bachelor's degree.
And probably save yourself a good amount of money in the process too.
Yes, and make yourself very hireable.
And so it's interesting because a lot of the people that I deal, because I'm primarily dealing with recruiting software engineers, and the majority of the folks that I see, they do have their master's. And I come across folks who have a PhD from time to time, but you're definitely right. The majority of folks who I see who are actually getting into the company are the folks that have a master's program under them. But that's something that's specific to engineering. So I don't want someone who's listening to this to be like, oh, man, I have a degree in X. Like I automatically have to go get a master's because that's not the case for every program.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, I'm speaking specifically as an engineer.
And was there any motivation to want to apply it towards teaching eventually, or was that a non-factor? Would you see yourself going to academia?
Initially, I did. I feel like I hate to say this, but actually going to graduate school made me less likely to want to be a tenure professor. It's just, it's basically like being a graduate student times 20, the amount of pressure and work you have. But I wouldn't mind in the future just being an adjunct professor, just teaching a couple of classes that I could see myself doing, less being a tenure track professor, since most of the time it's less about teaching and more about getting published, getting funding, making the university look good by your funding dollars and your publications.
So it sounds like a lot of politics.
Yes, a lot of bureaucracy as well.
I should know this, but I do not, and I'm therefore going to assume the listeners do not as well, although they're probably all smarter than me. But what would be the difference between adjunct and tenured professional? I should know this because my dad is literally an adjunct professor, so he's probably going to curse me out when he hears this.
That's awful.
Well, quick, short tangent. It's like, well, I don't know about y'all. I never knew what my parents did. I didn't know how much money. They always told me how broke they were. We ain't got money for this and that. It wasn't until I was literally filling out the FICA.
The FAFSA.
When I was filling out the FAFSA, that's the first time. I was like, what? this is how much money we make? It was, yes. That was a very bad weekend for all parties involved. So that being said, I still don't know. That's a long-winded way of saying I still don't know all the details of what my dad does for work because he hides it from me. So if y'all could, one of y'all or both of y'all, if y'all know, could explain that for me.
Well, an adjunct professor, I usually think of it as sort of a contract position. So you're contracted to teach a certain amount of classes for either a semester or a year. And then after that, they can either ask you to come back to teach those classes again or other classes, or say thank you for your time. We don't no longer need your services. Okay. And basically, a tenure track is they hire you for a certain amount of years, and then after that, you apply to get tenure. So that's basically applying to have a guaranteed position for the rest of your life. And so you have to go through a whole interview process when you're ready to have tenures. So most of the time, if they hire you on a tenure track, you're an assistant professor, then you move up to associate professor. And then when you get tenure, you're just professor. And so if you make that tenure track, then you're professor and you have guaranteed employment. But it's a very hard process. It's mostly like having enough publications, having good research, having significant funding, making a lot of contributions to the university. So it's tough. It's like 7 years of craziness and then hopefully guaranteed position. But it's not guaranteed. There have been times where professors have gone up for tenure and not received it. And basically, you have to leave the university because you're not going to get tenure there.
Yeah, I imagine that that can have a pretty acrimonious ending for some people. You do all that. You're like, I did all this, and nothing.
I could definitely see some people going on their Tom Cruise speech for that one.
I'm actually surprised we don't hear about that more often.
Yeah, I hadn't heard anything about that before this conversation here. So, of course, you made this decision that, you know, you're not going to go that route for all of these different reasons. And you ended up going and working, I guess, what would be in the private sector?
Yes.
And so I know, just given the nature of what you do and some of the other things I read, that there's probably a lot of confidential and secrety type things. But how did you end up moving into the private sector in the space that you're in and whatever you're comfortable sharing?
It was, once again, mostly taking my own initiative, because when you go to graduate school, they mostly focus on getting you to a professorship. So they really have a lot of information about applying to postdocs and applying to universities, but less about transitioning to the corporate world. So it was mostly like me going online and just looking at positions, looking at companies on my own time when I was close to the end of my dissertation and defense.
And did you feel like you had to do a whole lot of interviewing and applying, or was it a situation where you're like, that's where I want to go, submitted an application, and they were like, hell yeah?
It was hard because when I was finished, it was basically towards the middle of the financial crisis. So there was a lot of companies in flux and not really on the hiring so much. So I feel like it did take me a few months to find something during that time.
So basically, for people who are searching for jobs, ain't much changed in the last however many years. It's the same type of process for everybody.
Right, exactly. And sometimes you just get lucky and you find something.
So I had advised some people on another show to approach the job search as if it's your job itself. So 40 hours dedicated to your job search. I think most people, they scroll in the morning and then they watch reality television for the rest of the day. I'm like, that's not how any of this works. So did you tailor your job search to overcome that lackluster, I guess, hiring environment?
Yes, I was constantly on my computer looking at jobs, tailoring my resume, writing cover letters, every time, even if I was sitting on my sofa watching reality TV, I was also on my computer, Google searching everything and working on my resume. So it was definitely a full-time job for me.
Uh-oh, tailored resume and cover letter, Rich. I know you like to hear these things.
Plug, plug, plug. I ain't even got my sound effects today. I'm actually kind of salty about it. I'm like, I probably won't need this. And now I'm like, where's the explosion and the flex bombs? I can't find it.
Post edit.
Yeah. So, in thinking about that transition from the research world to actually working, starting a job in corporate America, what was the most challenging thing about that transition for you?
I think it was hard to get used to people being at different stages in their life. Since I had been in school for 10 years or so, I was kind of used to everyone. We're all on the same track. We're all young. And then I get to work and they're like people with kids my age and people who've been working for 20 years. And it was just like, you want to say something, you're like, you have no idea what I'm talking about. So it was getting used to that. It was also getting used to, for me, it was a sort of a culture shock of the lack of diversity.
Mm.
Going from university to corporate, because my undergrad, I went to HBCU. And then even in graduate school, I went to a PWI, but there were still programs in place for people of color. So you kind of around diverse people.
Right.
Even a lot of times, especially in engineering graduate school, you have a lot of international students. So it was, I had more diverse people around me. So that was sort of a change going to the corporate world.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to ask, even from grad school, were there other women engineers around? And that may sound like an ignorant question. Like, of course there were other women engineers around, but I know people who've worked in environments, and I've worked in environments where even as a black man, I've been the only one. So is that something that you found yourself experiencing in either grad school, or, well, I guess you said it was a little bit more diverse, or maybe even in where you are now in the private sector?
In grad school, there were very less women engineers. I think I was one of three. There were three of us.
Wow.
In our department. So, and then surprisingly now at my, where I work now, there are three women engineers. Out of, and our location's pretty small. We have less than 50 people in the entire office. So having three women engineers out of 50, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I'm like, yo, that's greater than 2%. Like, you're making real damage over there.
I will say I'm the only black female, but I'm one of three females.
Wow. That's
and great. the only black engineer. So I'm both the only black.
So you are quite literally the black.
Yes.
And I bring that up because I think we actually shared this in the most recent newsletter. There was a lady who wrote a fairly humorous article, and she was talking about they needed a diversity panel, and they asked you, the woman. So she was like, I guess I'm the woman on the panel. I guess the diversity in 2016, I guess we're still struggling up those steps.
Yeah.
Yes, I am the speaker of the black experience in my office.
You are the chocolate delegate. Yeah. We might have to get you that t-shirt. Like, you are the one. Like, oh, we're looking for a diversity panel. Katisha, are you free this weekend? Like, that's got to be your role. But so how have you adapted to that, you know, going from the environment where it was a little bit more diverse, and I guess there's three there now total, but, you know, being the black, how have you, like, what have you done to kind of adapt to that? Or have you just kind of taken the same approach that you were taking before?
Yeah, I kind of just do the same thing. I just go to work. I in my location where I am now, I basically have my own office. So I'm basically in my office all day, which I kind of like, because I'm not really a social, talkative, small talk person. But there's also even when I'm walking around, I listen to my iPod basically all day. I listen to a lot of podcasts. So even when I'm walking around and I do my polite hi's to people, I still don't really talk to anybody. I kind of like it that way, since I'm not that sociable of a person. So mostly I just go to work for work, and then I live my life outside of work, and I treat it that way.
I kind of have to talk.
This reminds me of two scenarios. So I'll just say one of my previous roles, actually quite a few of them now that I think about it, I was also the black, except I was the black guy. And I remember I saw another the black guy respectively for his department, and like, it was always confusing. I'm like, all right, do I head nod up or is he cool? And I head nod down. Like, so I see him coming down the hallway. I'm like, I'm going to go up. Oh, cool. He did it up too, man. Oh, man, we bonded. And then there was another time I saw this guy who actually worked. I'd seen him a few times. We had interacted. But he gave me like the Marlon Wayne intricate hand dap, like out of nowhere, like hugged me all up. Like, yeah, man, keep it real. You got to get out here in the streets, man. I was like, this is like a 15-minute handshake. I don't even know half the moves of the handshake. Like, it was, I think it was overly urban. Like, I think he was overcompensated, like trying to look cool. But it worked. I was like, actually, I think I texted Rich about it. I was like, I didn't know we were this friendly. Like, it was very involved greeting. So do you have any experience like that where, like, you see another unicorn, another the black, and then y'all have to, like, go through a slight rain dance to acknowledge one another?
Not really. Our building is very small, so mostly I just see my other coworkers who do the polite smile and nod, and I do the polite smile and nod. Either that, or I try to walk past without having to make eye contact for the entire time, because it's weird to walk down the hallway and just look at someone. Yeah. I find that very uncomfortable.
Do y'all have, maybe this is just me, what I hate even more than that is the long hallway walk where you're like, all right, see you later. And then you both are heading the same direction. It's like,
whew. Yo, I definitely went in the bathroom and didn't have to go. Just like, oh, I gotta cut over. I gotta go see John. And like, John isn't even in that day, just because I don't want to have that awkward double goodbye situation.
Yeah, man, we had a notorious hallway for that where you never knew, because it was like 50 feet. It actually might have been 150 feet. It was like the length of the building connected two different buildings. But if you weren't careful, you might be like, okay, see ya. And then y'all would head down. And then like, now it's awkward. Like, do we walk at the same pace? Do I slow down so they can go ahead? Should I speed up? Yeah, that, I mean, it gets a little real out there with these social interactions, I guess.
Yeah.
We have our hallways are narrow. So we have the weird thing. If you're both coming towards each other, it's like, who's going to move out of the way to let the other person pass. So that's a dance that happens often.
Yeah, it's even worse.
Yeah. I usually have the one where we're approaching from opposite directions and I'm like, all right, how long before I say hello? Like, do I say it like five steps in? Or do I wait till they're like a few feet away? Because if you like wave and then you just approach each other and you're just smiling the whole time, it's like, all right, I've been smiling for like a good 25 steps. Like, I definitely said, hey, too soon.
I'm happy that other people can relate to this. I don't know if anybody listening to the show can relate, but at least that's three, you know, 3 to 300, I guess.
Yeah. So before we jump out of work and talk a little bit about money, is there any advice that you would give to women who were thinking about following a similar path? You know, maybe they're like, I want to be a mechanical engineer. You know what? I haven't had a challenge in a while. I'm going to go for my PhD. Is there any advice you would give to someone who's coming up, who's, you know, kind of at the start of their journey and thinking about this?
I would say make sure you choose either, no matter if it's a school or a job, something that fits into your personality. For me, it was going to smaller schools. You know, you could have gone to like a MIT or something like that, a big school known for engineering. But for me, my high school was small. We only had like 100 people in my class that graduated, and a lot of people, that's nothing. So I liked a small school where the professors knew me, I knew them. And then also I wanted to go to HBCU for my undergrad. I just wanted to have that experience of being around people that look like me and we're all working towards the same goal. And then even in graduate school, I also picked a smaller school. I liked the support system they had for graduate students and what they had in the department. So I would say don't always go for the big name that will look fancy in your degree, because it doesn't really matter if you don't even make it towards the end. Pick the school or the place that fits you and your personality. You know yourself, you know what you need. Look for that.
And I'm glad you said that, because I can think of people where I went to school, and I went to a PWI, which, if you're like, what the heck is a PWI? It's a predominantly white institution versus HBCU, historically black colleges and universities. And there were people who, I could tell that they really struggled their freshman year. And there were folks who I saw at the beginning of the year who I didn't see when it came time to come back sophomore year. And a lot of that had to do with the support network. And in some cases, these people going from an environment where they saw people that look like them on a regular basis to not seeing people who look like them, except for like maybe two or three times here and there on campus, when it's like, oh, hey, we're both eating in the same spot. Let's sit together, because like, when else are we going to want to run into each other and be able to have this type of conversation? Wim, anything else you'd want to ask on this one before we jump to the money stuff?
Thinking about my high school graduation, I think we had a body of about 400. So I actually think 100 students dropped out, because I think it started at like 596. And we would always get these little cards that said where you were ranked, because in Texas, if you were in the top 10%, at that time, you could go to any public school for free. Well, it wasn't for free, but you could go to any public school that you wanted if you were in the top 10%. And I remember our knowledge wasn't wide enough. We just kept wondering why that number kept getting smaller. But now that I look back, that's dropouts. Yeah. I mean, dropouts and moves and other not so happy stories, but I think primarily influenced by the number of dropouts. And it's interesting that as a student, or you know, I guess a teenager, like you can't even fathom where those people are going. I'm like, those people are no longer in school.
Yeah.
That wasn't even like an option that I even considered. I'm like, dropping out never crossed my mind.
Nah.
I was like, that's not even an option.
Yeah, that's something I never even thought about. I was like, I have to finish. Like, I have to, like, to me, it was like, it was a matter of what I'm going to do after I graduate, you know, and, right. and what type of job I'm going to, where I'm going to be working. Of course, what I thought I would be doing turned out to be completely different than what I actually ended up doing. But I think that's the case for a lot of people. So let's talk a little bit about the money side of things. So as we also mentioned up front, you've got this robust financial system in terms of the different accounts that you have set up. And I was curious, was money a common topic in your household growing up?
Not really. I think the only thing was really when I turned 16, my mom was told me it's time for you to get a job. And she took me around base on base. There were basically three places you could work. You could work at the PX, you could work at Burger King, or you could work at Domino's. And I worked at Burger King and my brother worked at Domino's. And she's like, save money, which to a teenager, it's like, what's that? I want to buy, yeah. I want to buy stuff because I have money now and I can buy whatever I want.
Yeah. So what's the PX?
The PX is the exchange. It's mostly like a sort of like a mall on base where you can buy things. And since it's a military, it's significantly discounted.
Oh, it's like, okay. It's like, I was going to say it's like commissary, it's like, but I'm like, not at all.
Store.
So as it relates to money topics, and it sounds like, and it's a similar story for me, the lack of discussions that you had at home, would you, or do you see you changing that dynamic for, you know, your children or your family? Because we never talked about money in my home. And I think it's strange now, having gone through this full journey myself, that my parents are actually great money managers. Like they had all the things in place you're supposed to have. They have separate accounts. They have retirement funds. I now found out that my mom's like a great money manager and never talked to me about these things. But it was like a taboo or like forbidden topic to talk about money and money management. I guess it was just assumed that you would do right. And they would make sarcastic comments when I did wrong. But we never really sat down and talked about creating a budget, managing finances, like what it looks like to run a household.
Right. Yeah, I feel like I've learned things on the fly, just living life and going and digging myself out of my own financial mistakes is where I'm learning. And yeah, I think in the future, it's something I feel like is important for children. And also in relationships, something important.
And I was going to ask if you've always been good with the bucks, but it sounds like you've had your stretches where you weren't as good with money.
Yeah, no, I guess it's me. I was focusing more on the education side and less on the budgeting side and building the household and the financial future. I was just like, oh, it doesn't matter. I just get my schoolwork, get an education, get a great job, live a great life.
Mm. And so when did you kind of say, all right, it's time for me to really get my stuff together and start putting these systems in place so that I can have this happy financial future and not be living in Struggleville?
Mostly, I think a lot of it was reading a lot of articles. I'm a Pinterest junkie, so I have a board basically dedicated to money stuff. And also, seriously, I'm plugging for you guys. It was listening to when you guys GOS and listening to Wim's story of getting out of his credit card debt. It was just like, oh, someone that I sort of know can do this, then I can do it too. Because sometimes you hear stories about people and you read the stories that they did it and you're like, that's not my life.
Yeah, I generally do appreciate that. I'm really trying to make that my selling point. I mean, it sounds weird, but my selling point, and maybe that's why it took me so long to get over myself, is myself, because I'm like, I don't know anything. I'm not even particularly responsible. I just am really driven towards outcomes and means to an end. And then I just put processes in place to get things that I want. And one of those just happened to be wanting to be debt free. But yeah, I read those same articles. It's like, you know, we make $258,000 a year. And we were just on HGTV looking at our $800,000 house. And after the $1 million room upgrade, we decided if we stopped taking the dog to the shampoo shop twice a week for $1,500, we could pay off our debts in 6 months. And I'm like, what? Whose life is, what are y'all talking about right now? And I'm reading this article more upset at the end. And I'm like, that's not a reality that most of us could relate to. Like me, I'm like, man, I went to the club. I made it rain. It was dumb. We popped bottles. We had a great time. I don't know how I'm going to pay this off over the next 3 months, but here's a plan that I'm going to put in place to do so. And it's like when I hear, and I joke around, but when I hear like the Kanye lyrics and the Jay-Z, and people like, all they do is talk about money and making it rain. Oh, it's so disrespectful. I'm like, I would do it too. If I had the means, I would be doing those things. I just don't. I live within a budget because I have to. I don't want to. It's just, you know, I think an honest portion of the population is, hey, you know, budgeting sucks. And I think you buy people in when you're just honest with that. Like, hey, this sucks. It is what it is, but it needs to be done unless you got a platinum album coming out, unless you got to watch the Throne mixtape dropping. You know, these are other things that you need to do to get your financial house in order.
Man, those people with the mixtapes and the albums droppings are oftentimes the ones who are in the worst type of debt.
And we talked about this on a few shows now, and I think it'll continue to come up. I can never figure it out. So I'm actually like, I've been paralyzed by analysis before. Like, I'm so logical, like boxed in. When I would be in school and people were buying all the cars and rims, I couldn't figure out the math. I'm like, how are these people doing it? I literally know what this person does for a living. That dude owes me $20 and he has a $20,000 system in his car and he's sitting on 25. What? How? How? And it's only like now, as Rich was, we were joking offline, like, oh, they had school loans and they were cashing checks and they're indebted right now. Like, they were spending money that they didn't have. They were literally living outside their means. But even while I was watching it happen around me, I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. These people don't even have jobs. I'm working three jobs and I can't ball out like these people. What am I doing wrong?
Yeah.
But because I couldn't figure it out, I just didn't do it. I'm like, they must know something. Maybe that wake up now pyramid scheme I need to jump on, man. That guy selling, that lady I saw her selling those tea shakes, man, that must really be paying off. But I didn't know the gray money, as I call it, that they were moving around behind the scenes, or not moving around.
Yeah. Right.
So, Katisha, what do you think has been, or what would you say is probably the biggest misconception that you think people have about money from, you know, the people that you've talked to, friends, family, coworkers? Like, are there any kind of common points you've noticed, or even for yourself, like a misconception, something that you thought about money where you're like, well, that's not actually how it works at all?
It's you forget that your gross income is not the income you're going to take home. You forget about the taxes and the taking the money out for retirement and all that stuff. So I basically say you take your gross income, what they say your salary is, and you cut it in half, and that's what you're going to make.
Yeah. And I did not use that formula for like my first few jobs out. I was like, I'm making this number. Dope. I can't wait. Was already spending, but you know, I basically accepted an offer and treated it like I got an advance.
I think I would also say, and I am still to this day, I think even 24 hours ago to this day, surprised how little things add up. I'm just like, okay, I'm gonna go out, you know, a quick little happy hour, grab a couple of drinks, maybe we'll grab something to eat. And then it's just $75 here, $55 there, $65 there. And it's like, did I just spend $300 on food and drinks between Friday evening and Sunday morning? Like,
yeah.
What? And I'm just surprised. I mean, when you get into those habits of, and I don't know another way to say this, but I can do it. But I don't need to do it. Like, I'm at a place where I could cover those things, but it's actually Mint and all these little, you know, I'm going to try Level out next. All these little budgeting apps are just like, you spent $800 on entertainment. I'm like, what?
When I used Mint, I always hated when the little budget went to red. It's like,
yeah.
I was trying so hard. It went to red and it was only the middle of the month.
Yo. Well,
my eye-opening experience was, now mind you, I just moved back home, you know, and I was re-emerging with my friends. I just, you know, I don't even know the word, I'm meeting up with my friends again. I'm back on Facebook. And I looked in the Mint one day and it was like 60% bars and alcohol. And I was like, man, you got to get it together. It was like the wake up call. When that little graph pops up and it like starts scaling back and forth, and the orange, which I think is like entertainment and alcohol and bars, was like half the scale. I was like, look, man, look, we got to do something about this graph.
Yeah.
But I think that's why you need those systems. That's why, that's why you need a budget. You need a budget.
Yeah. Yeah. So are there apps that so we just talked a little bit about Mint, and it reminds me of that painful net worth thing, which made me realize that I literally ain't worth nothing, but I'm
not worth anything. It's a sad thing to look at.
It's like, I'm making progress. I'm doing these things. I'm supposed to be living the life. You know, you got the job, you got your own place. You got all of this stuff. That's going on. You're saving. But then when you look at the debt and everything else, and you're like, I'm actually worth a negative number. I need to do something about that. So are there other apps that you use aside from Mint that have been really helpful to you as you've went about kind of getting your systems in place?
Well, I did use Mint. I'm currently not using it anymore. Basically,
if you're like me, you probably hate grocery shopping. And if you're like me, you probably hate figuring out dinner every night. And that's where HelloFresh comes into play. So HelloFresh is the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. Each week, HelloFresh creates new recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes for everyone from novice chefs like myself to seasoned home cooks. And one of the best things about this is if you're cooking just for yourself, each meal could last you 2 days. I discovered that when I was making this sizzling beef stir fry last week. I promise you, it really was sizzling. And if you're wondering how the food gets delivered, it arrives at your doorstep in a special insulated box for free, 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 free. So for $35 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and enter paychecks. Again, visit HelloFresh.com and enter paychecks when you subscribe. Check it out.
I liked Mint, but the errors in the updating of the accounts and all the time. Oh, and yeah. I think at one time, like, one account just never updated and it totally messed up my budget all the time. So now I keep it simple. I just use my bank apps and I use my Google Sheet document and I keep track of everything that way. Mm-hmm. So that's been helpful for me.
So you become a little bit of an Excel guru?
Yeah, something like that.
So let me ask you that, because I've actually said a couple times on a few shows that simplicity is actually more telling. Have you found that forcing yourself, well, forcing is maybe the wrong word, volunteering, my boss told me you get to come to work. He's my boss, though. So you get to track your budget. Did you find that when you do it yourself, it causes you to be more proactive or more knowledgeable about where your money is going?
Yes. Because I have everything basically in categories. So I budget everything out in categories and I just add whatever when I spend in the category, I just add to it. And sometimes I see too many plus and numbers in a category. I'm like, I should probably stop spending money because I'm adding too much to this. Mm. And then also it automatically updates how much money I have left over on my sheet. So that also calms you down when you see the number drastically reduced after you put in everything you spent for the day.
Yeah, I have that optical illusion where I actually logged into my bank account. I thought I was being responsible and I glanced at available balance. I was like, oh, ball out. And that was not the balance. It turned out there was like 10 pending things if I had just clicked to the next screen. So that's good to hear that you're tracking it in real time. You know?
Yeah, that's, I try to do that. So as soon as I pay a bill, I put it on that and I kind of use that as my everyday. And then every few days I sort of check my bank account to make sure they're kind of matching.
So do you have a time that you set it? So is it like every night you take whatever receipts you got during the day or whatever you paid online and you just add that in? Like, so because to me, my bad. I was going to say, to me, when I think about manually updating and I've had these periods where I've had like literally Ziploc bags filled with receipts that I've, it's, you know, and it's receipts that I, and sometimes the receipts will be at that point where you can't even read what's on there anymore because it's sat there for so long. It's like opaque. So do you kind of set aside time maybe in the evening or in the morning, or do you just immediately when you get back to your desk or the first chance you have a computer, you go in and update with what you've spent on?
Yeah, I try to do it automatically. So I have Google Sheets on my computer, and I also have it on my phone. So if I'm out and as soon as I spend it, I try to go to it and put it in automatically so I don't forget. So that kind of helps me that way too. So then I automatically know, hey, this is how much money you have left. And that sort of works for me because most of the time you always have your phone. So it's not that go to the app and add the what I just spent in there. It only takes like a minute, less than a minute.
That makes me feel really lazy about having to automate everything. Which, you know, that and I think one of the key takeaways from this is what works for one person isn't necessarily going to work for the other person, but there's a system or some method that a person can set up to work for them to make sure that they're able to accurately track all of their stuff and stay on top of all of their finances. So you mentioned that you have a bunch of different bank accounts now. So how many accounts was it?
I think it's 8 total.
Got it. So can you walk us through just kind of how that started? You know, I'm assuming you probably had one checking and then you started building out additional accounts. So it'd be helpful to understand kind of what the impetus was behind adding some of these additional accounts that you've added over the years.
Yeah. So mostly it started with, I started with a checking and savings. With Navy Fed, that's probably the bank I've been with the longest. We're a military family, so we got Navy Fed. And so I've had them. And then we also, when I got a car and I had to get insurance, we have USAA, which is another banking service that's available for people who, military family, I think even people who work for the government, DOD stuff, can use. And so they also have a banking system that I used. And then recently I joined Ally. Ally was my bank for my emergency savings account. Mm-hmm. But after I read, there's an article that I sent you guys about the different bank accounts that someone used for their budgeting system. I decided that it would be good for me to try out. It seemed like it would help me keep track of my budget. That's when I added some additional checking accounts to my Ally banking account. And then I had to find another savings account because they say you shouldn't have your emergency savings account the too easy access with a checking account because you can just sort of say it's an emergency when it's really not and just transfer the funds over really quickly.
Oh man, I've did that on so many nights where there's been alcohol involved. Like, oh, I'm only moving $50. Like, I can put that back in next paycheck. But first I have to remember while in a drunken stupor that I removed $50. And of course, when I get paid, I'm already thinking about what I want to do after that.
Right. So I opened up my emergency savings at Barclays. They're really good because they still have 1% interest on their accounts, and they're also only for savings. So there's no way you can open a checking account there. So it could be strictly for savings, and you can have multiple savings accounts there. So that helps out too. I also have my business checking and savings. I use Capital One 360. Mm-hmm. And I drive for Uber on the weekend, so that's sort of my side hustle, creating multiple streams of income. So I keep that separate because they say you should keep your business and personal accounts separate. So it makes it better in tax season when tax season comes around.
Yeah, I've definitely made the mistake of having all the funds in like one account, even with like past media projects, managing all my money plus whatever business money was coming in. And it made things, I can tell you firsthand, it made things incredibly painful around tax time. In fact, even right now, like literally right now, I'm dealing with some stuff with taxes from like 2014 because of how stuff was filed for the business that I was a part of. But there was a period where everything was in my personal accounts and it was all mixed with my money. So I think that's definitely a great point for people to separate that stuff out as soon as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I've been driving for Uber for a year and it was personal. Then I was like, after I read a bunch of articles, I was like, oh, I better separate it to make it easier.
Right. I was going to ask one or both of y'all, did y'all coordinate with the CPA in this lane while y'all were setting those up, or did you wait till the tax season? Because I, from personal experience, there's been a couple of times where I'll do something unique in the year, but I only need to talk to a CPA once because it actually turns out to be more minor, or they'll tell me the forms that I need to use. But did y'all, I guess, consult with anyone in setting those areas up?
I didn't consult with anyone since it's not like I have a big business corporation. Mostly they said it didn't have to be anything special, just something separate, that if the IRS came and said, show me your statements, you could show them that you have something separate away from your personal.
Got it.
So someone hearing this, they may be like, that's a lot of different bank accounts. You've got the business things, you've got the checking, you know, that's a lot. So I guess what would be your response to that? Well, why do you think this really works so effectively to you, or effectively for you?
For me, I think it's good. I can label all my accounts, because now if you do online banking, they let you name your account something different. So it doesn't just have to be checking or savings, because it will be hard for you to figure out what is this for. So I name, if it's just for my bills, my rent, things like that, it's my home checking account. So I know everything that deals with that comes from that account. And the home savings account, it's any money I have left over from that month, I just move over to my savings account. And then if it's personal, it's just for me, my personal bills, like car insurance, my gym membership, things like that. So I think it's easier for me that I labeled them to have all those multiple accounts, so you sort of know what it's for and what you're using it for. I use my fun funds account for going out, movies, dinner, drinks, things like that.
Tearing
so I
up kind the club.
Of know. Yeah. So I kind of know what the purpose is. And it also helps when you separate, especially when you have a good weekend and you go out and you're like, oh crap, I got to pay rent on Monday. Am I going to have enough money in my account? It's like, I don't have to worry about that, because that's in a separate account just for paying rent. And I don't touch that except for paying those bills.
Right. And, you know, it's similar. And I guess that's part of why you wrote in. I got to this point where I was just spending all out of one account. I mean, and so I had a few accounts. So I have Ally too. I have like a checking and like two, I have like a money market and then just like a online savings, high interest, which is only like 0.015% more than like the money market account, which I thought was supposed to be the better deal, but have since found out that's not the case. And then, you know, I had a Bank of America account, which was my all-purpose account. Some months I'd pay rent out of that account. Some months I'd move money over and pay it from a different account. And I was like, all right, the only way I'm going to be able to really get a handle on where my money is going and making sure that I'm allocating properly is to set up accounts for specific purposes and let direct deposit go into the appropriate account. So now we have a Wells Fargo account that's specifically for rent. And then we have an account that's specifically for other home expenses. And then, so similar to you, I have a checking account that's for bills specifically. So my car insurance, other things that I have to pay. And it's made a world of difference in terms of just being able to know that bills are going to be taken care of because I already have the automatic transfers and everything set up, and not having to look at what used to be the all purpose account and say, do I really have that much money left?
Right. You think you have more money than you do, and then you pay for it a few days later.
Yeah.
You go too, if you turn up too much at the club.
And I'll jump in just in case anyone listening is remotely interested. So I have a much simpler system, which is actually forced upon me and Rich is familiar with, because now I get paid once a month. So I just pay everything on the second. I don't trust myself. I know I've learned over the years that if I hold on to that money, I can't be held accountable for the next 29 days. So I just pay everything on the second. And so I know, with the exception of that appending versus available balance, that everything in that account, and I have a savings account and it drafts automatically. And then I have my, right now I'm allocating 10% to my IRA. It used to be 15, but I think I'm down to 10. And so other than that, I guess, and I've talked about this on another show, the check-to-check strategy, as long as all your bills are paid and you're allocating to your savings and you're allocating to the appropriate IRA, you know, it's not recommended. Of course, you don't want to have money month to month, but I feel like if you're doing what needs to be done, then, you know, that's your money to have fun with. And the lovely ladies of Whiskey, Wine, and Moonshine, I wish I had this book in front of me, but she also had another example that it's like 60% for bills, 20% for savings, and 20% for fun. And I just bring those up because I think people are intimidated by a budget because I think they incorrectly think a budget tells them what they can't do, and it actually shows you what you can do. Right now, you're just kind of operating in this Pandora's box of spending your money and then wonder where it's gone at the end of the month, and that's just not a good place. My father put it as more month at the end of your money. you need to stop doing that. And so it really helped me recalibrate how I was going to approach the month.
Yo, man.
Yeah, I feel like I'm living paycheck to paycheck, but with my budget, I have money to have fun stuff and I also have money to save for future emergencies. So it feels like I have more money than I did before I even had a budget, and I make this basically the same amount of money. It's really weird, but it works.
You know, well,
I'm glad. I'll let you jump in, Rich. I'm glad you say that because there was an article that talked about that most people would rather have more money in savings than make more money. So it's the idea that you feel like the feeling of having more money is actually more important than making more money.
Yeah, man. And so the other thing I was thinking about before I forget, because my brain has a way of doing that. So you can live paycheck to paycheck and it sounds like you're being irresponsible, but you're actually being responsible. Like all your money is going to the appropriate place. And after all your money has gone to the appropriate places, you just don't have a ton of money left, but you're still saving at the same time. So so there is a responsible paycheck to paycheck life.
I agree. And people kind of hear paycheck to paycheck, that's bad. And I think it just goes back to debt is bad. And I'm like, there's good debt, there's bad debt. And there's a good way to live paycheck to paycheck. And there's a bad way to live paycheck to paycheck. And that actually came to me from a listener comment, like, okay, you know, they wrote in, or I think they actually hit us on Twitter. And it was like, all right, I can only do one of these things. I can save for retirement. I could pay all my debt. Or I can establish 6 months of savings, but I can't do all three. Mm-hmm. And I think up to that point, I was operating under the assumption that people could, I mean, that you could do all three. And I really think that we'll get more breadth of coverage if we're like, okay, you know, where to start. And I think what's difficult for people, and I've definitely shared this with folks, it's not easy to prioritize because sometimes it's a choice. Now, I did come down with a decision that I do think if you're choosing between saving for retirement, paying off your debt, pay retirement, because you know, unfortunately the way debt is set up, it's not going anywhere, but you will inevitably retire. Your debt, there's different mechanisms that you can adjust and fix and resolve and improve over the course of your career. As you make more money, you establish a career path and you grow, but you are going to retire, and the compound interest gains, as I've seen on all these charts, and we talk about the cup of coffee, the cup of coffee scenario put into a 6% earning is like $1.5 million in 50 years. But you know, that's still true. I mean, you joke about it. And I just think you get more bang and turnaround on your money. If I was in my 20s and I was making those two choices, I would actually tackle. I wish I had more aggressively tackled my retirement.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's an area where people really drive. I mean, I wasn't really aggressively going. I mean, and I could still do more. That's something I'm actually going to look at next week, is how much more I can turn up. But a lot of people are so focused on the current, trying to make sure things are paid now, that they got the money, the appearances, all of that other stuff, that they don't think about attacking that as aggressively. And one thing that that I kind of realized recently, and I talked about this on Twitter some, and Katish, it'll be interesting to hear if you've ever been at a similar point, but I was looking at my savings like, yeah, I got, you know, I got like a month or 2 months of expenses. I can cover an emergency. I'm living it up. Like I'm being responsible. But then on the other hand, I still have this credit card debt, and I happened to get a call from like a financial advisor who was calling just to give advice. And I'm like, do you sure you don't want something? He didn't ask for anything on this call, but I know in like 6 months, he's going to be like, okay, so now you got your money, right? Let's talk about setting up this program together. I'd be like, I knew it. It's a swindle. But he basically said some things to me that made me look at the debt, and he's like, hey, yes, you're building up this savings. Yeah, great. If you can live for a month or two, like that's ideal. Do you feel like your job is in jeopardy? And I was like, well, I mean, no, not at the moment. You know, I'm pretty confident that within 2 or 3 months time, nothing's going to happen that's going to have me out in the street. And he's like, well, this would probably be a good time to think about tackling some of this debt. And so I looked at it and I was like, you know, I could keep accumulating the savings and keep paying slower on debt and keep accumulating this interest, or I could bite the bullet now, take a little bit of a hit in my cash, and completely pay off a card that has been responsible for probably thousands of dollars of interest over the years. And so just last week, I completely paid off one of my credit cards, you know, and prior to that call, it was kind of like, yeah, I'm being responsible. I'm taking stabs and swipes at my debt, but I want this debt gone. And it's really about where people want to prioritize, ultimately. So, Katisha, have you had any realizations like that where you thought you were being kind of really effective and efficient with your money? And then you're like, you know, there's something I could really be doing better. And maybe you made some type of sacrifice.
Yeah, I think for me, it was saving too. I mean, I have my process of my plan to get out of debt. And basically, that's why I'm living. That also came into creating the budgets, because basically half of my income is just going towards paying off my debt in my 5-year plan, mm-hmm. basically pay off like my loans and my credit card debt, but I still have some student loans. So I'm budgeting on living off basically half of my income. And then for my savings, what I was doing was sort of spreading it around into all my different goals. And then it's in one of the articles I sent too. It's yep. like they talk about the snowball effect of paying off debt, but there's also the snowball method of saving money. So instead of spreading all your money to all these different goals, just putting all your extra money to one goal so you get to that goal faster. And then once you get to that goal, you can move to the next goal. So that's what I'm on now. It's like my current savings goal is to have enough emergency savings for 1 month of expenses. And then once I'm done with that, I can save for the next thing, which is probably saving to move to a different apartment. So that would be the next saving goal.
Yeah. I like that. And that's part of why, you know, I set up some of these additional accounts recently where I can be like, okay, this is the emergency fund, not the emergency. I need $10 so I can buy this drink. Like, this is for something for real that may come up that I may need to pay off. And then this is the for real. Like, if I do lose my job, I need to be able to live for a month, not, I lost $20 playing some game and now I need to transfer 20 to put that back. And that's been really helpful. I can go, okay, boom, that account is where I'd like it to be. Great. That account is where I'd like it to be. On to the next thing.
Yeah, and I'm going to touch on, I want to let the listeners know that we'll put that Saving Snowball article in the show notes. And I want to go through the numbers just, Rich, you knew I was over here doing this.
Oh, of course.
So people can wrap their heads around what I'm talking about. Because I've talked about this on the show and some people, they disagree. And I mean, they're fine to do so. But I'm just going to use IRA as an investment retirement account, not specifically a Roth IRA. I'm not advocating for one way or the other. But if you do it before taxes, that's $100. I'm going to use $100 as an example. And you might have an employer match. And I've talked about getting the employer match. The second you say, well, you know what? I want that $100 in my pocket. It doesn't work that way. So if you had a 25% tax rate, what you're actually saying is I want $75 in my pocket. Plus, I'm losing the employer match. So you're taking money away from yourself, whether you realize it or not. And you're like, well, I'm going to take this $75 and apply it towards paying off my debt. And I'm like, you just lost $25 plus an employer match, plus any investment interest that you would have got on your savings. So that's what I'm talking about as far as when you have to choose between, especially if you're young. I mean, it starts to change. And I'm going to say young is on the right side of 20. whatever age you feel, I know 40 is the new 20 or whatever case may be, whatever you call young. But the younger you are, I just think that you should really focus on it. And I just wish I had. I'd be in a completely different place if I had. And then, you know, another reliable, if not the expert source, I was surprised by this. Dave Ramsey, I don't think it was recently, it was like 2 years ago, wrote an article that said, in his opinion, if you have to choose between establishing an emergency fund, which most people think 6 months, they get intimidated by that number just itself, and paying off your debt, he says, put $1,000 in savings, then pay off all your debts. And I was just surprised that it was such a small amount that he would recommend for putting into your savings account. But I get it, because I think, well, I can't speak for him, but you know, my thinking has definitely evolved on most people can't do it all. Like, we can't have it all, and we definitely can't do it simultaneously. So most of us will have to choose, okay, what am I going to prioritize? And that's why I haven't read it yet. I'm definitely interested in reading this Saving Snowball article. anything that can set up a foundation for, you know, how can you go about prioritizing all these things that you want to accomplish over time?
Yeah, yeah. And Katisha, she definitely sent us a good list of articles. I was trying to read them beforehand and I was like, all right, I'm doing way too much and I'm gonna stress myself out. But we're gonna end up including some of these in the newsletter, of course, also in the show notes as well. And before we wrap up here, Katisha, is there anything else that any other tips or anything you'd want to share with people who are kind of at the beginning of their financial journey in terms of getting out of debt or saving or just being responsible?
I would say definitely if you have a job, it has a 401k, like Wim always says, always take the match. You'd be surprised how little it affects your take-home pay. You won't even notice the difference. If it's 5%, you won't notice the difference. And when you get a raise, I always bump up whatever percentage my raise is to my 401k. I don't notice the difference. It's made a world of difference. I really like logging in and looking at how much money's in my 401k and that I'm on track to retirement.
Awesome. Nice. Awesome. Yeah. So it has been fantastic having you on the show. Thanks so much. Well, for first emailing us back about that episode, because that's what led to us being able to put together this conversation today. And I'm sure people listening are kind of like, that there are some things that make sense to me now. I will say, now I had my first experience with a black Uber driver probably in the last month or so. It was a black woman actually. And I didn't know it existed. I mean, I knew that we rode Ubers. I knew that we called them from our phones, but I didn't know that like we were out there in those Uber streets. And so, yeah, I guess before we wrap up, I do have to ask what that life has been like driving Uber. I imagine you've probably met some interesting people and hopefully not had anything too interesting happen in the backseat of your car.
No, I've met some interesting people. They're pretty funny. I tell some good Uber stories to my significant other. He really likes to hear my Uber stories. So it's fun. It's been fun and a good way to spend the weekend driving people home late at night after they've been at the bar.
Oh, okay. That's you did answer. Cause I was going to ask, I have a couple of friends that either do Uber, Lyft or a number of other service car sharing services. And I have some, they're like, look, man, I stop at 12.
I start at 11. I go till four.
Yo, she's so brave, man. She's like, this is going back to everything. Yo, there's like a defined path or there's like a type. You're like, challenge. What's the worst time to go do that? I'm going to do it then. I'm going to clean up. I'm going to be the person out there caking off of that. What else can I do? Pole vault over some alligators? I think I'll do that next weekend.
That's where the money is. I mean, that's why people rob banks. That's where the money is.
Well, Katisha, thanks again so much for joining us. It's been wonderful having you on the show. And I hope folks benefit from this.
Me too. Thanks for having me, guys.
And there you have it, our first episode with the PNB listeners. So shout out again to Katisha for joining us. And if you have thoughts or topics you'd like to hear us cover on a future episode, you can email us at info@paychecksandbalances.com or send us a voicemail by visiting paychecksandbalances.com and clicking on the tab. I think it's orange. That's floating on the right side of your screen.
And one of the good news takeaways from me and Rich finally meeting in person, even though it happened after the fact, I finally learned how to log into our email. So you might actually hear from us. We have our personal emails as well. Both our names, Rich or Marcus, at paychecksandbalances.com.
There you go.
Speak to Rich, rich@paychecksandbalances.com, or myself, marcus@paychecksandbalances.com. And we both check the info account. Also, my book, Debt Free or Die Trying, is available for purchase on Amazon at paychecksandbalances.com/debtfree. If you're not ready for that level of commitment, just start with our email list. It is free, and you'll receive the PNB Weekly, where we cover top stories we found throughout the week, career money management tips, and a lot more. Again, that link to sign up is paychecksandbalances.com/email.
I see what you did there, brother, and I respect it. Yeah, so we want to thank you again for listening. Definitely cop the book. Well worth the read. Very funny stuff. And also got some insightful, helpful tips in there. And definitely sign up for the email list. So looking forward to seeing you on there. But until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.